Miss Judy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. So, hey, tell us about you.
As a blind student, I did learn to use a sewing machine when I was in a home ec class at the D&B school in Colorado Springs. And I just got really excited about that. And I told my mom about that. And she goes, oh, you could use my sewing machine. She had a Singer Featherweight. So off and on through life, I've sewn things. I've sewn garments. But more lately, over the last few years, it's been more mending and hemming and things like that. But yes, you can be blind and use a sewing machine. And so some of the things you would use would be a seam guide to help you on the straight seam. And one technique that I always use, you know, you don't want to get your fingers near the needle. But, you know, as it's going up and down, you know, a lot of people are really afraid of that. But as a blind sewer, excuse me, what you can do is you can keep your fingers close to the presser foot where the needle is operating, but you keep your fingers down, like on the machine itself. You know, the minute your fingers start going up in the air, the needle might catch them as it's moving. So if you're getting close to the presser foot, you want to keep your fingers down on the machine itself, you know, on the platform right there. The other thing you can do, too, if you're doing some really tricky sewing on curved seams or on thin seams, you need to start at a certain point, you know, where your seam guide isn't really going to help you that way. You want to be really exacting. Position your needle by hand, you know, by turning the little wheel on the side of the machine. And with one hand, and then on, like with me on my left hand, I can feel the needle going down on the material. And you're doing this by hand, so it's going very slowly. And you can feel where the tip of the needle is exactly going to go onto the material. So you position it there, you make sure your material is positioned to where you want it, that it's not wrinkled. And then you can feel the little middle notch in the presser foot. You know, make sure your material is lined up the way you want it to go, and away you go, start sewing. And if you're doing curved seams and, you know, seams that are just really different where you have to be more exacting and they're not straight seams, you just do this slowly and check your presser foot, you know, stop and check your needle every so often when you feel like you need to, make sure you're lined up correctly. And anyone who sews with a machine will know what I'm talking about. You do not need your eyes to be exacting on this. And I will say on patterns, the assistance I have needed on patterns when using pattern is when you go to get your patterns, have someone, there's like a heavy edge on the pattern that needs to be cut away, and I need help in getting that cut away, you know, around the pieces. And then also the darts. You can mark your darts with Scotch tape. I don't think too many clothes have darts in them that much anymore. Sometimes, I mean, of course, you'll see garments that do, but things are much more relaxed nowadays, but darts can be marked with Scotch tape so you know exactly where to pin, you know, when you're doing your patterns and what to do. So anyway, that's enough about sewing, but what I really wanted to cover was hobbies in general, because as many people as are out there in the world, there is a hobby, and they may be the same, they may be different, but what I want to talk about are strategies on adopting hobbies as a blind person. And if you use two of the strategies I'm going to mention, you are going to be successful at working on your hobby. One of the strategies is, and you've probably heard and we'll hear about alternative techniques. And what these are techniques of doing things without vision that you can do with vision. And as you know, there are some people who have more vision than others that don't need as many alternative techniques, you know, they can use their sight. But if you're coming across a technique of doing something, whether it's housework or anything, and you don't have enough sight to do it, then you use what we like to call alternative techniques. And again, that's a technique that you would either figure out yourself or learn about that doesn't require vision to do it. And I'm here to tell you that just about anything except for driving a car at this point in life has an alternative technique you can do. So pretty much you can do anything as a blind person that you could do as sighted. You just have to figure out the technique of how you're going to do it. So what I'm talking about, the two strategies are deciding on your alternative technique you're going to use in your hobby. And then the second strategy is more of a philosophy, and that is becoming a problem solver. As a blind person, you are going to need to become a problem solver if you're not already. Decide you're going to solve a problem rather than come to it and say, oh, I can't, or I don't know how, I can't imagine, I can't do it. That's not correct. You need to just come at it like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to work it out? And you might even be saying to yourself, wow, this is interesting. How can I do this? As long as you're saying how instead of can't, you're in problem-solving mode. I am retired, and I used to be a rehab instructor, among many other things. But one of the things I saw in people who were losing their sight was that people who in life had been taught or had maybe parents and family or an upbringing of being a problem solver had a much easier time adapting to losing their vision if they were a problem solver to begin with. And it was just a really interesting observation in human, in the human experience as far as seeing how people approach blindness and what they do. I saw many people develop their own techniques of doing things. This one guy knew that blind people used a cane, but he didn't have one. He knew he was going to need one. And he was, he was a builder and did some things. And when I first met him, as I was at his home, and he was coming in the back door, and he was using this huge piece of plumbing pipe going, just coming in from the backyard, thinking, well, this at least is my cane, so. But you see people doing all kinds of things. I've seen, I didn't see this one, but I heard about someone out in the country who was trying to develop a way to get around out in the country. And he put a wagon wheel, like a little kid's wagon wheel, he mounted it on the end of a broomstick, and he was wheeling that in front of him. Well, that isn't going to make an adequate cane, but the fact is he had an idea of something he was going to try because he knew he needed something. And as long as you're strategizing and working on problem solving, so again, looking for those alternative techniques that you can do your hobby without sight, and then deciding yourself you're going to be a problem solver. You are going to be setting the tone for your family and friends as a problem solver, because most of the public out there, and unfortunately including your doctor, is going to look at blindness as the problem. But you are the problem solver, and you are going to be the one to come up with your solutions. And if you can't come up with your solutions, guess what? There's a lot of us out there who can help you with this. One thing I always like to tell people is that when you have your sight, as you have your, if you find out you're losing your vision, you may lose some of it, you may lose 50% of it, or you may lose all of it, or you may lose a little bit. It's hard to say. But if you're losing your vision, decide what you're going to do. One thing I like to say is a savings account. Think of your alternative techniques as a savings account. So I'm retired, so I'm not working now. But the thing is, when you're working, you're putting into a 401k, or you're putting into probably some kind of plan that you're going to be using once you retire. And I like to think of alternative techniques as your savings account. So during your experiences at the retreat here, you're going to learn things that you may not really need yet, and that's okay. We're not here to say you need to use every single alternative technique you learn just because, that's not what I would really doubt that's what is being said to you. It is fine to use the vision you have for the things you can do as long as you are learning an alternative technique to take over should the time come you need to use that. And a lot of this, again, is in your attitude of being a problem solver. There is nothing wrong with using your vision for things that you do as long as it's comfortable for you. But when it starts to get uncomfortable for you, or you start stressing over a task because you can't see it, that is a good indicator that you need to pull this alternative technique out of the toolbox. And the best thing about retreats like this are that you're going to be learning a lot of techniques to stash in your toolbox. You're getting a lot of currency put into this savings account in case you need to pull out some of these used later on. You know, definitely take this savings account seriously. Put into it. Learn from it. These are the two things that really are going to make hobbies the easiest, is getting a hold of these alternative techniques, storing them in your toolbox, and adopting this problem-solving philosophy, because you are going to need it and you are going to be successful when you do. The thing about hobbies and activities is when you ask, well, does a blind person do this? Does a blind person do that? For every hobby or activity out here in the world, there is more than likely a blind person doing it. I went to school with a guy who's a lapidary. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but he is a rock polisher, smoother. He does the whole trade. He does jewelry settings and all kinds of things like this. And he's the only blind guy in the country. He's totally blind. He's the only blind guy in the country that does this. He lives in Wyoming. There's a guy, I think, over in England that does it, but he is a lapidarist. And, you know, he had parents that supported him. He was really interested in it, and they didn't tell him, oh, I don't know that a blind person can do this. I don't know if a blind person should be around the diamond, you know, saws. I don't know. You know, if it occurred to them, they let him at least go ahead with it. And so he's an accomplished lapidarist, and he's been doing this for years. So I would say that, you know, don't think about your hobbies and things about you have to give up because you're losing your sight. There is going to be someone out there who is doing it. I'm so glad I did this, but I almost made a bad mistake when I was a rehab instructor. I had someone approach me with a client who was losing their sight, who was a cosmetologist. And in my mind, even as a blind person, I mean, I am not an authority on what blind people can and can't do by any means. I just know what I can and can't do. But I was younger, so I will attribute that. But, you know, I'm hearing about this person who is losing their sight that's a cosmetologist. And immediately in my mind, just to show how programmed I was with society, I was thinking, oh, wow, they're going to have to change their career. They're going to have to. And fortunately, very fortunately, I stopped myself. And what did I do? But I called the NFB and, you know, I was a rehab teacher at the time, of course, and I called the NFE, and I was sure they would, well, I wasn't sure what they would say, but I called and I said, you know, I've got a referral for a client who's losing her vision who is a cosmetologist. Do you know of any blind cosmetologist? And it was a clearinghouse. It was like a jobs clearinghouse kind of a thing they had going on where you could call in and check on these things. And I said, do you know of a blind cosmetologist? And the immediate answer was like, oh, yeah, there are three of them we know of. Do you want their contact information? And I'm like, yeah. So that was a really good learning lesson for me. It was very humbling because I should have known better. But never, never, never underestimate the abilities of people who sighted or blind, because you just don't know. And so it's always best to ask. Assumingly said, well, the only thing we can't do is drive a car. Well, I'm going to be proven wrong when we get these self-driving cars, you know, tested and safe and everything too. But anyway, as far as finding out about alternative techniques to ask, you know, how do you find out about a technique you want to use in a hobby or in a life skill or, you know, anything? How do I find out about this? Well, the NFB has, if you're on computers, the NFB has several listservs you can get on. There's one for performing arts. There's one for Crafters Corner that you can get on. There are so many, I couldn't even begin to mention them here. but they are all resources of people who are out there doing things and activities. There's, you know, where you can ask your questions like, how do I do this? Blind gardeners, blind ranchers, farmers. I don't know. There's a blind, I don't know if they're still in existence, but there's a blind equestrians list. If you've got, you know, if you think you can't ride horses anymore, guess again. So there's just all sports, you know, another thing. Golfers, there's blind golfers out there. So I'm certainly not an expert on lots of things, but there are blind people out there who are that you can get answers from. So get resources. Ask other blind people. If you know other blind people in your community, ask. Or if you know other blind people, just other blind friends, ask. If you don't, what's really interesting, do a YouTube search, you know, just put in something like blind biker, you know, whatever, but do a YouTube search and I'll bet you will find a blind person who's doing it. There is also a channel that I think is way cool that a young lady started, and I think she was an NFB member at one time, if she's not still. And she has this channel called Breaking Blind, and she talks about how does a blind person do this, that, I mean, anything from pouring a glass of milk to doing your grocery shopping. But it's a great channel, and she's got a great attitude. So that's just one example. If you're not on the computer and you're wanting to find information out about from other blind people, if you are not on the computer and you have a hardwire phone and that's all you've got, get the number for your state affiliate. And I'm sure you could get these with help through your retreat. If nothing else, get the number for the national organization, the NFB, and they can refer you from there to get you the trickle down to people in your state, to people in your locality who can come alongside you and help mentor you. Also, in when you're checking with that, check with your agency for the blind in your state, whoever that is, to see if they can refer you to any support group that they might be sponsoring or holding in your area. But again, you got to decide to be that problem solver and start building up those tools in your toolbox.
This is June A. Mason from Colorado, Denver again. I would like to know, first of all, I live in a senior independent living building, and I'd like to know if or how I can get in contact with a knitting group, if be possible. I do some of that on my own right now.
Some of the senior buildings, like the one I know several people, they form their own, you know, and you might be the very person they need to help them actually to start one. So if you know, for instance, the building manager or the front desk person or any of the staff members in the build, and you can say to them, do you know of anyone else besides me that likes knitting? Because it would be nice to get together. And, you know, it's like having a coffee group or something. You know, you get together and you make friends and you talk to people and you're knitting away. I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about, that it's really nice to be able to share. So that's what I would do. Just ask around. Is anyone else in the building knit like I knit? I do know some people in my building who knit. And again, calling out the local library, and do they have a knitting group? And the local yarn shops, those are the three things that I would really, even if you're a churchgoer, there might be people with the same church who are seen knitting in in church. So there really are plenty of people out there, and they would love to know you as well. This is the thing, you know, we have to think that we're not bothering everybody because we want to share what we enjoy doing, because they are going to want to share it with us too.
Everyone who does not have email or uses a computer, you will be getting all this information in hard copy, and or if you tell us, I think it can be arranged, it can be put on some type of recording so you can put it in your NLS player. So there's an audio version, a hard copy version, then the electronic version of all this information.
So you'll have my email and my phone number.
They will.
And I'm happy to talk to anyone who wants to talk to me.
All right, let's see, 856.
Yes, my name is Linda D. Bargis. To the person who just called, just asked a question, you can also call the national office. and ask about the Crafters Division and when they meet. That might help you too. Mrs. Jones, can you tell us about your music boxes that was in the agenda?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is talk about a hobby of mine. This is just awesome. I mean, I think it's just awesome. I almost obsess over him, but I have had a love ever since I've been young of the antique music box. And I had godparents who had one. They had lived over in Germany. They were Air Force, like my parents were Air Force. And they had one, and I used to go down to that basement and play that thing, and it had discs that went round and round, and it had bumps on the bottoms of the discs and that's, of course, what plucked the comb of the music box that makes it play. That's generally how mechanical music boxes work. So it's either on a disc or a cylinder, but you got these little protuberances that pluck the combs that make the music. So anyway, that fascinated me, but my family was ended up being stationed overseas, and while we were over there, we got us an antique music box, and I have it to this day in our house. It's got 18 discs, but I just love the tone of it. And then as I got older, I got interested in the mechanics of it. And I'm an armchair mechanic, I will say. I'm not like a repair person. I don't varnish or do anything like this, but I'm very interested in this. And when I was in college, I got to do my thesis on, it was like thesis for my bachelor's. I went into teaching. I was in education, but we could do a thesis on anything that we liked, and we weren't limited. It didn't have to do with our specialty of study. So I thought, oh, I could do the music box. And so I thought, oh, I'd love to do that. And I did. And I just enjoyed that. I learned so much about them. And then in the digital age, I ended up finding people who had sent videos or audio recordings of their music boxes online. And YouTube is an amazing place where you can find all kinds of music box music. I started out finding about music box music with Napster. Anybody, those who've been on a computer for a while, remember the Napster service, which was, you know, kind of like YouTube Music, you know, one of those. But that's where I started first collecting my digital collection. And so now my digital collection of antique music box music, I've got them all in playlists, and I have, I have, I think, 700 and something in my music box playlist. I have a music box Christmas music playlist of about maybe 300. I'm not really sure. And then I have a music box hymns playlist, which has about 60 some in it. But if you love antique music boxes, and Robert, of course, knows that he can share my, email and phone number. But anybody who would like that, I'd just be glad to share my playlist with you guys.